Hi, and welcome to Forest for the Future, the podcast series where we talk about innovation and trends and grand ideas in the world of sustainable forestry, climate mitigation, and of course, FSC. Today, we are actually going back to basics because we have an exciting episode focused on one of the most common questions I've received in my 20 years in FSC, which is, how does FSC chain of custody actually work? How does auditing work? What does companies need to do prior to getting certified? What do they need to do to get ready for an audit? And what happens during an audit? To guide us through this topic, I have invited Cesar Goncalves, the policy manager for Control Wood and Chain of Custody at FSC Policy and Performance Unit. And the bonus part about him is that he's also an experienced FSC auditor. So let's welcome Cesar to the podcast. Welcome, Cesar. Before we dive into the actual questions on the chain of custody audits, can you just tell us a bit about your previous role and how that helps your work and shapes your current position in FSC?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me. So before I joined FSC, I was working for a certification body, focusing on technical management of the clients and the business development side of things. And that included as well conducting chain of custody audits to our clients. So that gave me also the perspective from the auditor side. But even before that, I was working for a certificate holder, a certified company. So I could have the two perspectives from being the auditee and being the auditor. Personally, I find it helpful in my current role at FSC when it comes to the drafting of the requirements, so you could put yourself in the shoes of both the company and the auditor that is actually evaluating those requirements.
And in your current role, like right now, you were heading into a revision process of the chain of custody. What are you really focused on then in improving in the next version of a standard based on your previous experience?
So one key thing, of course, is that we have to follow the integrity side of things to make the standard stronger, of course, but also to streamline the standard itself. And that includes and connects with the previous question, which is making it more accessible to people to understand. Again, from both sides, from the company that is implementing and from the auditor that is seeking conformity against those requirements.
Can you give a specific example?
Yeah. So you may know that throughout the years, we have dozens of interpretations, dozens of, let's call it corrections or amendments in form of what we call advice notes. And one of the objectives is to reduce the amount of it. And why in the first place did we have those amendments or that need for clarification? It was because perhaps we were not being so explicit to certain situations, and therefore companies or certification bodies don't actually know what do we mean by a specific requirement. So that is one of the key focus is, of course, we have to follow drafting rules, but within those boundaries, those rules, we also have the freedom to further explain something that could come in more simplified wording of the clause itself. It could be via a note, it could be via the non-normative forms, such as guidances and so on.
Okay. Well, interesting. I'm sure we'll come back to that later in the podcast, but maybe let's just start with some of the basics, the thing that I think people is here for. I've worked with FSC for 20 years. I've lost count of the amount of times I've been asked to explain the process of chain of custody audits. So that's why I invited you here, because I know that many people are really like, what's actually going on during those audits? How do we know things, etc.? So let's start with the basics. How often does FSC chain of custody audits happen?
Once a year. Of course, in exceptional cases, maybe more frequent or less frequent.
What are those exceptional conditions? Like, when do they happen more frequently?
So let's imagine that you as a company decide to extend your scope of certification to a new production, a completely new set of products, new facility that will require or may require for the auditor to do an extra check during the year. Or, for example, let's imagine that there's a substantiated concern that something is not going well with a given company, and the certification body is made aware of it. As a system, we can request unannounced or short noticed audits to check that the conformity.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, you might already be preempting my next question, which is, why are these audits so important? What actually happens at the audits? What is it that we're auditing?
From an FSC perspective, they are important because of the integrity of the system, right? And before that, maybe let me just explain the concept of FSC audit. When we refer to this, what we actually mean is a third-party independent audit. That means that the so-called certification body has no relationship with the company, so on a non-biased way, they can assess conformity against FSC requirements. So that's why they are important for our system. So we ensure that companies that make use of FSC claims and the FSC trademarks, they are doing on the right way. For the company, is of course some sort of a level of assurance. You as a company, you implement your procedures, but you don't know if they are actually correct or not, because it's your own interpretation. How should you address those requirements within your own scope of certification? So having the audit gives you the assurance that you are, again, on the right path.
So it's like an exam. Can you fail the exam?
You can fail the exam. Let's call it three possibilities from an audit. Either you pass with flying colors, nothing was identified, everything is perfect, or there are some mistakes, but they are not that critical, okay? It's not like you are going against one of the fundamental principles of FSC. So that means that the auditor will raise audit findings in form of minor nonconformities or major nonconformities. And each one, they have, of course, process timelines that the companies are required to follow to close those nonconformities. But I'd imagine that you, your company, you fundamentally fail. There's so many nonconformities or major nonconformities.
Could we give an example of a nonconformity and a major conformity?
You have many requirements in the standards. The auditor raises nonconformities against each requirement, right? So if you completely fail the conformance with one requirement, that means a major nonconformity by definition. If it is a partial conformity, that means a minor nonconformity.
Okay.
And if there's something that it yet does not constitute a nonconformity, there's no evidence that it was a mistake, but there's already indication that it may be in the future, we classify those as observations. So the company can use those to improve the system before the mistake actually happens.
Can you be more tangible? What happens if I fail to train employees during the year in my COC procedures? Would that be a major or a minor?
It can be a major because, as you phrase it, you fail to train the workers. Let's imagine that you did most of the training, but some are still yet to be completed. You didn't manage to have the time. So that's a minor nonconformity. It didn't result in anything current as FSC certified. So that would qualify as a minor nonconformity.
Mm-hmm. And how many of these did you say that people could have, major or minors?
So there's no limit for minors, but it gives, if you have, let's say, 15, 20 minor nonconformities, that already indicates that the system is not ready. Five or more major nonconformities gives you immediate suspension of the certification and your rights withdrawn.
And what happens in the case that I have one, two, or three?
So you have 3 months to close it. And so you have to implement the corrections and a corrective action plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's now imagine I'm a certified company. I want to avoid all of those corrective actions, right? So what is the process that I have to do before my actual audit happens?
Let's imagine that you have a company and you have an interest in going for certification. And for the sake of the exercise, you are a mid-size sawmill or a small print shop. You already passed the steps of learning what it is FSC, but the facts are is that you don't have any certification that you can compare with. So you don't know actually how the process it works. So you already went to the web page, you talked with an FSC network partner, they helped you guide you on the process, but what are actually the steps? The FSC network partner absolutely can help you on that. And they will point you to the certification bodies that they are operating in the country, right? And then you start contacting these certification bodies, of course, for quotations, it's a service, and you engage with one of them and you agree to be the service provider. And one of the immediate questions will be, are you already ready to take the first audit, what we call the main evaluation? And likely your answer will be no, actually, because I don't know how the process works. So here you have two ways of doing it. Either you implement the procedures, or basically is what we call the chain of custody manual. It's your own interpretation of the standard, how you do things. You can do it internally with your internal capacity. You study, you implement it. It may take you a little bit longer, but you can do it. Or if time is against you, you can always hire a consultant to help you in that process. So let's imagine, so the time that takes you to implement and to make your system ready for an audit, it can vary depending on the size of your company, the complexity of your process, how many facilities do you have, what we call the sites. So it depends on different factors, right? But it could be from a few weeks to a few months. For the sake of the exercise, let's imagine that you get the system ready in 2 months' time. Now it's the time to contact your certification body and say, hey, I'm ready, let's plan the first audit. You start to engage at this moment with the selected auditor or auditors. In some more complex cases, the audit team will be comprised by many auditors. So at that moment, you will fix a date for the audit, and then it's ready. So the auditor will ask you some documentation. Likely will be the chain of custody manual, the procedures that we were talking, the organizational charts. So they can send you an audit plan, so you know what will happen in that day or in those days. And that also helps that person, the auditor, to adjust the audit plan according to your specific situation. There's formal steps that have to be followed, but it has to be adapted to your kind of organizational structure. That is it. At that moment, you are ready for the first audit.
Mm-hmm. Can we break that down a bit? The actual chain of custody manual. What kind of things is it that I, as a company, would have to adjust, would have to identify, would have to build up processes for? Can we just pause a dem for a second? Like, what is it that I have to do to actually get certified?
Of course. As a system, we require that everything has to be documented. So that's why we are speaking about manuals, documented procedures, because the system in a company has to be independent from the people. If a person changes capacities, the system has to continue to go on without the people. And it's much more easier for a company that already has other certification schemes implemented, because they can use the same rationale or the same documented procedures and they can adapt them. So let's imagine that you don't have anything in our example, and you don't know even what does that mean, the documented procedures. So essentially, and simplifying a little bit, it's a manual. It's a translation from the standards to your own kind of organizational language. So it always starts with the description of the organization, a little bit of the history of the organization. What do you do? To whom usually do you buy? What do you buy? How do you transform? How is the process, the transformation of the of your products goes? And to whom do you sell? What are your products? And here you are always looking also to the FSC standards to see, oh, okay, I covered already these parts. And the FSC standards has the sourcing part, for example, when it comes to your suppliers. It has parts like the sales requirements, what you have to put in your invoice. That's how do you account the materials in your system? What kind of conversion factors, for example? What do you do to your workers in terms of training, in terms of the health and safety? What is the program for the training? How do you onboard people? How do you make sure that they know what they are doing? And also, and very important, is the social aspects as well, the well-being of the workers, what we call the quality requirements. So it's a manual that you describe how do you do things looking to the standards. This manual can be rather short if your business is also small, it's simple, it's, let's imagine that you are not processing, but rather trading. So there's no conversion factors. So you sell one unit because you bought one unit. You could have just a few pages of description, or you can have a super complex system that you have to break down that manual into several different pieces. So mm-hmm. each department can understand what they have to do. And you work with each department in defining the actual process, the people that are involved, what to do, right? Mm-hmm. Is basically, it's the interpretation of the standards.
Normally, when I describe it to people, imagining that they follow a product through the entire company, putting it in simple words, what happens, who does what by when, and how do you know, and creating that sort of description. But what then happens before the actual audit? What do you have to prepare for the auditor to see that you send in advance?
Yeah. So point being is that we require for the system to be always up to date. So it's mm-hmm. not that you pass the first audit and then you can relax until next year, right? You still have to keep your records up to date, the trainings, everything that you propose to achieve conformity, you still have to keep those records there. And one example, record all the inputs and outputs. And towards the end of the year, what you do as a company is, you know, how much have you bought and you know how much have you sold. So then you have an annual summary as an example. So these are kind of records that you prepare also for the auditor, because he needs to start somewhere, because an audit is a sample-based exercise, right? So that means that the auditor looks at the company or the system as a whole, and then the auditor selects specific cases, examples to try to track what actually happened with the product from the moment that you bought it until the moment that you sold it.
Mm-hmm. How do they select those?
It's completely random. That's what we say and that's what we recommend. So you should not and you cannot be guided by the company. So you cannot accept that the company says, hey, I have here these invoices you'd like to check. No, it's completely random. So one thing that I was doing was I was looking, again, let's imagine a small company exercise. You only had a few dozens of invoices in that year. So I would open the summary of the all sales in that year. And I would say randomly, I would point in that month, give me the first invoice that you have on that, give me the invoice on the 15, and so on, completely random, because that is part of the exercise.
Mm, okay. And maybe that's a good segue into actually talking about the audits. What happens at the audit? Now, we're at the point, we've sent all the documentation, we've agreed on a date. What then happens when that auditor arrives at the company?
There's some formal steps that have to happen. And usually, I would qualify those as the opening meeting and the closing meeting. Those are the two key formal moments in the audit. Within, the flow of the audit can and will depend from what is the organizational structure and actually also the auditor's own style of auditing, if I can say so. So let's imagine I arrive at your organization. We have then the formal opening meeting, we do the round of introductions, we explain the objectives of the audit, what will happen in the day, any disclaimer that is needed, and we identify already if there's a need to any change in the audit plan. Because the audit plan was already circulated within the departments of the company, everyone agreed to be available at the specific times. So we kind of clarify in that first moment if there's any change. So then I will give you my example, my own style of auditing. I would then move to what we were talking, the documented procedures, key specific things. If it is the first time that I'm going to your organization, it will take me a little bit more time to understand what you do. And one piece of advice for an auditor is to, it's better to go to the production floor sooner rather than later. Why? Because you are seeing with your own eyes what actually the company does, and not being based on what the description that you see on the manual, on the procedures. So you get, as an auditor, you get that feeling more quickly. And also you have the chance to collect some references that you can bring and then check in the company's system. Then let's assume that we started then procedures, we confirm the scope of the certification, the products, any changes, and so on. I would go then to the production, still in the morning, imagining that it's a small company, one day audit, still in the morning, I would go to the production and I would follow the flow of the transformation of the products. I would start from the reception and talking with the people there, and then moving every step in the production, how do they segregate things, and then the dispatch, the finalized, finished product is dispatched. As I'm walking through, you don't follow the standard as it is. You adapt your assessments towards what is happening there. So at the same time that I'm, for example, interviewing someone, the auditee, I'm also looking to other aspects. For example, I may be asking you about what are you doing in terms of that specific task, but at the same time, I have an eye in terms of health and safety requirements, for example. I'm seeing if you have the protective equipment required and so on. So you try to optimize the audits so you don't go back and forth and you do it once and you talk with people once.
Mm-hmm. How many people would you normally talk to during such an audit?
Let's imagine that you are a super small company and you have 5 workers. I will talk with the 5 workers. If you have 100 people, likely I will talk with 10, 15, 20 people. It also depends on the optimization of the process and the repetition of the production. So if you have multiple production lines, I don't need to see every single one, but probably I will pick some people from each one. So it depends how it is structured. But to say that it's not percentage based is not fixed, because it may depend on what you encounter.
What are the typical kind of questions that you would ask from these people?
An interview or a conversation, a talk with a worker has to be made in confidence. So it's your responsibility as an auditor to set the right environment. It's a comfortable environment. It's a safe environment for the worker to speak their minds without having a kind of pressure from supervisors. That is a key thing for us. We tend to start on a more generic way, using plain language, so the person starts to get more into the conversation and starting with open-ended questions. Otherwise, if you start already jumping to closed-ended questions without a briefing, explaining what are you doing, what is the objective of the conversation, and so on, you will find a person that it will not be willing to give you the information. It will give you yes or no answers. And that does not help for the whole assessment process, right? So that's why sometimes it would take me half of the time that I will be talking with a person, talking about generic things that have nothing to do with what is happening. But that builds the confidence that the person has in you. And then you talk about a specific task. People are always or tend to be very proud on what they are doing and how they are doing. And you work with that towards the more specific aspects and always navigating not only on what is happening, but also covering the other parts, as we were mentioning about what it is, the work environment, the social aspects. So you navigate the conversation, you deep dive in some aspects when you see that there's some kind of behavior or a mood that is changing. So you try to seek more in that regards, because maybe the person has something to say, but they don't feel yet comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So would the manager typically be right there next to them as well as they're being interviewed?
So the manager cannot be nearby. So either I'm interviewing the manager or I'm aside with that person. I may ask to just walk freely and talk individually with people. Otherwise, I would be accompanied by the manager that will point me, let's go this way. Here we have the production line and so on. And when I see something or I encounter a worker, I would ask, please let me have a few minutes with this person so I can ask some questions. So we are always a little bit apart.
If you look at a typical audit, how much percentage of time, this roughly, I don't know, it will vary, but how much time is actually spent on looking at procedures, looking at reports, looking at volume summaries and training manuals, etc., and how much is spent on the floor engaging with staff and going through the production floor, just roughly?
Yeah, using the example, that's a small company, one-day audit, probably it will take you 80% of the time in documented procedures, in records, because those are the documented evidence that also the auditor has to capture, right? And let's say 20% on the production floor, speaking with the people and seeing how things work. It may vary, it may be 60-40, for example, that proportion. It just depends, of course, how things are structured.
You would open in the morning, you'd go to the production floor, spend 20% of the time, maybe not, like an hour-ish time, and then you go back into a meeting room looking at documents. Is that how it works?
Yes, I mean, but looking at documents may be not the best term here, because when I'm referring to this 80% or the 60% that you spend with documents, you are at the same time talking with people. And talking with people, you are auditing. For example, you are talking with human resources about the training, how it is done, the resource management. Of course, you are looking to papers, you are looking to records, but you're also asking the person questions to understand if they understood what they have to do and what it is expected from our requirements. So physically, yes, 80, 20, 60, 40 depends, but it kind of blends one thing with the other because that's also an activity covered by the scope of the audit, right? It's not only you seeing the products, but what is happening around the product.
Mm-hmm. And all the people that you're talking to in that process, are they all notified in advance? Do they know that they might be called upon? Or can you actually call somebody in from the side saying, I want to talk to somebody from HR?
Both things happen. For the sake of fulfilling the audit plan, it's a good practice that the relevant departments or the relevant managers are notified ahead via the audit plan. But there's also this part of improvising, and when you are going in the production or you pass by someone, you should do that because that is part of not focusing on someone, but being kind of random, because on that randomness, you may find something, right? So both things happen.
Until now, we've described a lot of things that companies have to do, a lot of things they have to put in place. I'm just wondering, is there any spillover effect for the companies, something that they get in return beyond just a certificate and being able to sell things as FSC?
Absolutely. Maybe I will describe this as a personal example. It happened around 12 years ago while I was working. It was not a certificate holder at the time, and we were trying to implement the EUTR, European Union Timber Regulation. Essentially, my director said, please make us compliant. And we were kind of a small company, and as a forester, I was trying to do the best that I could, but I didn't knew if it was on the right track, if it was okay. And being a small company, we didn't ever received a visit from an external party to look into our process, to look into how do we do things. So I do remember that when we applied for FSC certification, actually it was the first time that we had someone saying that, okay, this seems to be on the right track and this is not so good. So I remember that we were much more relaxed in terms of, okay, now we know, now we have someone that's told us that we are doing things as they should. And that is kind of an example just to describe that this is something that companies take it from certification, from the process, especially the small and medium-sized enterprises. They never had any kind of certification. They never had any kind of external party visiting them. And it also brings one thing that is key, which is a pattern among companies, a way of working, a standardization of process and recording and reporting, because more and more companies, your supply chain will require more data, more information about the products. So if all companies follow the same rules at the same kind of way, that means that you are aligned, that you know what your client is asking because you had to implement it for your certification purpose. You are no longer in your own bubble, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you follow the same kind of structures. Have you seen any development in the FSC audits over the years? I mean, are things improving? Are they becoming more effective? Is it easier for companies to implement these kind of structures? Or have you seen any development over the years?
So it's very subjective, of course, but one could say that indeed it's a continuous improvement process. So it is expected you as a company that you may have more non-conformities in the beginning of your certification cycle, but then you learn by doing. So that means that you correct things over time and you optimize even your process, your conformance, and so on. When requirements change, that opens the door to potentially new mistakes. So it's kind of you restart the cycle again of, okay, now I have a few more non-conformities to address, but then you bring those down in the next year and the following years. So there is a pattern for companies to improve because they learn by doing and they are understanding year after year what they have to do. As for new companies joining the system, of course, nowadays they are much more prepared. When you compare when certification first started, and certification takes us back to the 70s with the ISO standards and FSC in the 90s and early 2000s. So when you compare who was getting certified at that time, 20, 25 years ago, were essentially big companies that they had bigger structures. They could make more investments in terms of resources and equipment as such, and even later in software. So of course they could achieve certification, I would say, a little bit more quickly because they had the infrastructure and the resources to do it. And more recently, we are seeing that more smaller companies are getting certified. And of course it's challenging for them because they don't have that kind of structure. So that's why it's also our job and the actors on the field, such as consultants and such, to bring those concepts down to a level that companies can understand. Because obviously, resources-wise, it's completely different when you compare a smaller company with a big company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think actually that's a really, really important point, because one of the biggest mistakes I've seen in my time in FSC is companies overthinking getting certified. I mean, most companies have what it takes in place to get FSC chain of custody certification. Essentially, what it requires is for them to be able to segregate what is certified and what is not certified, and to have proper health and safety and workers' rights implemented. And they have that. It's just a process of getting them certified is often just for them to pinpoint, oh, in that process, we're actually making sure that we onboard our staff. Oh, in this process over here, we actually already check what a truck is delivering at our door. We just have to also check whether it says FSC on the shipping note, instead of building these monsters of systems. And I think that's so important to get across.
Absolutely. Actually, it's a very important point, because our system is not tailored to a sector, to a company size. It's as general as it can be. So you as your company, you adapt the standards to your own structure, to your own activity. That is one big factor that we always have to have when we develop new requirements and such, to make them general so that they can be used and interpreted regardless of the complexity of your process.
Mm-hmm. Like, from an auditor's perspective, what is the most exciting kind of audit to conduct?
Personally, I cannot say that I have a preference, but remembering back in the days, as I'm a forester, initially I loved to make audits at the forest level. But then when I started on the pulp and paper sector, on the textiles, I found it's really great because it was sectors that I didn't had any experience. So I knew how to audit FSC requirements, but I didn't understood how those processes are. And you learn, it's not you as an auditor, it's not only giving the work, providing the service, but it's also taking something with you that then you build your knowledge, and audit after audit, you feel better in terms of now you understand the process. It's not the size, it's the type, it's the process, it's the optimization, is the level of control that excites an auditor, because we learn also from the companies.
Mm-hmm. I can completely relate. I always love going to new companies and learn how they produce stuff. And yeah, it also gives you a lot of interesting trivia. What are the most common mistakes that companies make before an audit, or that could have easily been fixed in advance? The most common thing that everyone gets wrong.
I wouldn't say everyone, because also it depends what kind of support you had, how how you prepared yourself. But the basic is insufficient description of the procedure. If you start wrongly doing from the beginning, you can expect that in the future, you will not have the basis for you to use those procedures as a manual, right? So in the first audit, usually what happens is that most of the non-conformities go against the procedures, how it is described, because it's not capturing all the information that you need as a company. And if you start like that, even if it's a minor non-conformity in the first audit, that will result in a major in the next audit. It will be a massive failure, because eventually you could perhaps make a false claim, for example, meaning selling something that is not, it was not properly controlled, and you are selling something that is not FSC certified. So that's why the first and second audits are very critical at the procedural level, because that is your guide. You as a company, if you need to know something, you can and should refer to your procedure. That is your guidebook, basically. And that is one of the most common mistakes, I would say.
Well, how could companies fix that in advance?
So, as said before, either you are working with internal capacity and you allow yourself more time to engage within the departments to improve specific sections of your procedures, either you are working with a consultant. And in those cases, likely what will happen is that you have, of course, some work to be done on your end, but the consultant is also an anchor in guiding you what has to be there, in training you, in supporting you. So that is a mitigation measure, let's say, to start on the right path, because you have an experienced person, and likely that person could also be an FSC auditor. So they know how they audit, they know what kind of questions you will have, so they can anticipate for you those flaws.
I've always used this method. Now I can test it on you, whether you think it's a good one or not. But I've always imagined that what I was doing is I was writing the steps down for a sulky teenager.
So
in that sense, you sort of, you only capture the most essential parts, but you also know that if they skip a step, there's an entire part of the process that's wrong, just gone missing.
Yes, just try to explain it in your documents as you are explaining to a six-year-old. Use plain language, be simple, but explain everything, because people need to understand without you explaining it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I have a question that, because I asked a couple of colleagues, what should I make sure that I ask CSER? And one of the questions that I got back was, I always get asked, why does companies have to shift auditors every 3 years? Why can't they just maintain the same auditor year on year? Because it's so much easier, because the auditor then already knows the company. They've built this trust with some of the employees. Why can't it just be the same person?
Yeah, you mentioned building the trust, and that is also the risk for the system. When that trust could eventually, over the years, let's imagine after 5-10 years, you as an auditor, you feel less part of the company. We are saying that you will become biased, but to a certain extent, you may overlook things because you think that you know the company. You think that you already saw everything, so you may relax as an auditor. That is from an FSC integrity perspective. From a company perspective, it's also positive that some changes happen, because as I said before, each auditor has its own auditing style. And when you have more than one auditor, that person can also bring a new perspective. It's not that the auditor is helping you to implement, but the auditor is seeking conformity, right? So depending on the person, they may focus more on a specific aspect, and then you realize that actually it was not fully covered. While other, on a different audit, they may be focusing again on a sample based, focusing more on something else. So that also interacting with different kind of people, different kind of auditing styles also helps you to build a more stronger system, in my opinion. Of course, it would not be helpful that you change auditor every year, because it takes you more time to explain. You haven't built that so-called trust with the person yet. It may take more time. People don't actually know how the process works. But as long as we keep, as you said, 2 or 3 years, maximum 3 years, that's what we allow in the system.
A lot of companies, they get nervous before an audit. It's a big deal for them. From an FSC perspective, from a previous auditor perspective, from a previous certificate holder perspective, what is your best piece of advice for companies starting to prepare for an audit? Let's imagine they're already certified, so not the first evaluation, but a re-evaluation afterwards.
So my advice is be transparent, because in terms of the consequence, it can't be that bad. Of course, mistakes happen, but the system has ways and allows you to correct those mistakes. So for the audit experience as a whole, for both parties, the best thing is be transparent, be open, because that will also put the auditor in a position that he feels confident that the company is trying to do the best that they can. So they are not hiding anything. There's no need to dig deeper. So it's a much more pleasant experience for both parties when you are simply open.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As part of that, remembering that what we're auditing here is, do you have processes in place? Do you have systems in place to segregate? We are not expecting 100% flawlessness. What we are expecting is proper systems and good system design. And that if you find that your system isn't working during the year, that you fix it, that you change the system, that you get a new reapproval of a changed procedure so that the system works in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Certification is still a voluntary system, right? So I do understand why companies feel more insecure, but the point being is that the auditor or the certification body is not a competent authority. It will not issue a fine. It will not put the company into a bad legal position, right? So within, of course, some boundaries for mistakes, there's always a chance to correct things and improve the system. And actually, that also gives the company this feeling of, I'm improving, I'm doing things better as I was doing last year. And now remember that some companies that are audited, I'm saying this on a more light way, but the feeling was, please find the mistakes. That's what I need from you, because my system is so complex that I need to be sure that things within all departments, within all complexity, they actually work. The message was, please find the mistakes so I can improve and be better.
That concludes our deep dive on FSC chain of custody audits. I hope that this episode has provided some clarity and practical insights for businesses who are looking into navigating the FSC certification process. I think it's most important to remember CSER's key advice: stay transparent. Don't try to hide stuff, because they'll find it anyway. And then my personal favorite: write your manuals as if you were writing to a 6-year-old child, because that way you use plain words and you remember all of the steps. And I think most importantly, relax. We might talk about this as an exam, but in reality, what it is an opportunity to write down all of your procedures, everything you're doing already, and then identify ways to improve them and improve them over time. Remember to subscribe to this podcast for the future. If you want to have more discussions on FSC and sustainable forest management, if you want to follow all of our different innovation tools, If you have any questions, if you have any topics that you'd like me to cover, then feel free to reach out on podcast@fsc.org. I am Laura Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.